Hi, I'm Natalie from Boston, Massachusetts.
I'm Zach from Madison, Wisconsin.
Hi, I'm Kent from Denver. The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like me.
If you'd like to support the show like I did,
visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Dave Holmes, and my guest this week is Bob Mould. Now, you might know him best as the founder of the 1980s Minneapolis punk band Husker Du. The band only had modest record sales at the time, but they have been a huge influence on alternative rock. After the band broke up, Mould went on to release several solo recordings, and in the mid-90s, he formed a new group called Sugar. Here's another fun fact. Mould wrote the theme song to The Daily Show. It's called Dog on Fire. He has now written a memoir along with Michael Azarod. It's called See a Little Light, The Trail of Rage and Melody. It follows his fascinating career as a gay guy both in and out of the closet in the alternative rock world of the 80s, 90s, and today. From their classic album, Zen Arcade, let's listen to a little Husker Du. This is Something I Learned Today. Welcome, Bob Mould.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
Excellent, Bob.
Thank you for the wonderful introduction.
Oh, thank you for being here.
Hey.
Welcome to The Sound of Young America.
Cool.
Read the early parts of the book when you and Husker Du are out basically evangelizing for American punk music. It is a scene that still exists to this day, but is not like you were kind of the first to really Xerox your flyers and get in a VFW hall and do your thing.
There was a great scene at the time. I mean, in the late 70s, we had the first wave of punk rock, bands that from England like the Sex Pistols, the Clash, the Damned, and it was heavily informed by a certain look, the Safety Pins,
right,
the sort of pseudo goth look. And then, the next iteration in America was, more of a West Coast-based, mentality. I think, Southern California, Northern California, towns like Vancouver, and then places like Minneapolis where Husker Du started and the Replacements started and Soul Asylum started. More of the flannel shirts, chains, military boots, skinheadish looking.
Right.
Hardcore punk. So, there was a lot of bands doing it at the time. But as far as Minneapolis specifically, Husker Du was the first band to truly get out and see what was happening and sort of gather information, bring it back, and start sharing it with other bands.
Right. So. And the fact that there was no internet, it's easy to forget that not that long ago, you really had to do the work. If you wanted to find your scene, if you wanted to create a buzz, you really had an enormous amount of work to do.
There was a lot of work to do. I mean, within each city, there would be certain outposts, whether it was a punk rock club or a punk rock night at a disco or a independent record store or, a fanzine that people might have, bands that were touring might take copies of their fanzines from their local town and leave them wherever they went. So it was a very organic way of sharing information with people. And, you had the right to be selective. You didn't necessarily give that information to the cover band at your bowling alley,
right,
in your town. So it was,
right,
when you knew that you found like-minded people, kindred spirits, you would share that information and help those bands out as well.
Husker Du in the early 80s
were something that was very brand new. You guys kind of created independent rock, I would say. You were on the forefront of alternative rock, meaning that you didn't have a massive label powering you, but you created a scene that was nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they kind of transcended the place where you came from.
Yeah.
And within that community, you were to some degree an out gay man.
Mm-hmm.
Was it easier within that community, would you say?
Well, I mean, the 80s music scene, the post-hardcore, pre-alternative rock, you know, that field of music was really what brought us together, was the rebellion against corporate rock. You know, going out and renting VFW halls. I mean, that was something that we could do for $100. You could bring a PA in and you could put a band up, and it really meant something to all of us. It was in the face of this corporate, Foghat, Rush, Kiss, Aerosmith kind of stuff that, you know, was unattainable. Specifically as far as, you know, gay punk rock or gays in punk rock, it was sort of like gays in the military, really. You know, it was like the era of don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah.
You know, it was sort of don't advertise, don't worry.
Yeah.
That was the, and bear in mind, you know, we were already, as punk rock, we were the outsiders. So, you know, the more outsiders we could gather, the better. So, you know, if you were gay and you didn't make a huge point of it, of course you were welcome because you were an outsider. So there was inclusion there, you know, mostly because the enemy was so much bigger, you know, in the Reagan years and all, you know, the Anita Bryants and all. I mean, it all overlapped. I mean, you could be, you know, if you wanted to be the token gay that, like, you know, Black Death put X's over Anita Bryant's face on your punk rock poster. That fit. It all, you know, I think there was a place for everybody within it, as long as they hated Reagan.
Right. That was Hardly Getting Over It by Husker Du. My guest is Bob Mould. I have to say, reading this book, I was blown away by how the story of the end of Husker Du is sort of famously acrimonious. You know, it's mm-hmm. and so much of it has not been told. You are very even handed in the book.
Thanks. I did my best. I mean, you know, in my private moments, I have different thoughts, but that's
right.
The beauty of this book and spending time really considering the whole, you know, considering it from everybody's perspective.
Right.
And then telling what I think is my truth and then, you know, moving on from it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
There's not only an incredible music scene in Minneapolis, but it seems like the worst breakups seem to come from Minneapolis.
What other ones?
Well, I go to The Replacements. Prince and Apollonia.
Prince and Apollonia was a shocker.
Right.
You know, I'm not, we've, the shockwaves of that are still resonating.
Still being felt to this day.
Yes.
What is it about Minneapolis that created the scene that it did? The cold weather.
People have to find things to do inside for 8 months of the year.
Right.
I think that, in the book, I attribute it to a handful of other things that conspired. You know, there was a gentleman named Tim Carr who lived in Minneapolis, and he worked at the Walker Art Center, and he was able to use that platform to curate some amazing musical shows, putting together festivals, bringing all kinds of great, you know, cutting edge bands from Europe and America to come and play at the Walker Art Center.
Right.
When you have something like that, that gives credibility, you know, then the local media gets on and they take it seriously. So I think that, you know, I think Tim had a lot to do with informing the scene there.
You then move on to the album Workbook,
mm-hmm.
which it was a hugely important album in my life. It was obviously in yours as well. It really set the stage for the rest of your career.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it allowed you to sort of use a different voice, yeah, literally and figuratively.
Yeah. In the wake of Husker Du, you know, it was early 1988, and I was very isolated. I was living up in a farm in Pine City, Minnesota.
Right.
And, you know, left to my own devices to come up with a new sound. You know, when I walked away from that band, I think instinct told me, don't try to do it again.
Yeah.
You know, do something different. Find your own voice. And, you know, spent a good 9 months experimenting with words and guitars and different sounds and ideas. And eventually it all came together. And, in 89, I put out the record and really tried not to draw attention to my past.
Right.
Record company, you know, their natural instinct is ex Husker Du stickers all over the cover, and I'm like,
sure,
just please don't do that. It's not going to help any of us.
It's the sound of Young America. I'm Dave Holmes, in for Jesse Thorne. That was See a Little Light from Bob Mould's first solo album, Workbook. See a Little Light is also the title of his brand new memoir.
And, you know, it's interesting to me that that your work with Husker Du and Workbook and so much of Tommy Keane's stuff in the mm-hmm. in the late 80s was all I listened to for about 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And now to, you know, now I'm 40 and it's, and you guys are both out of the closet and it's mm-hmm. like, what did I know about you guys sort of subliminally? Because yeah. your sexuality doesn't come up in the music, mm-hmm. but I was, it's, I don't know. There's a question in that pile of hay somewhere.
It's the same thing happened with me as a fan. You know, when I gravitated to the Germs, it's like, why would I, you know, why that?
Yeah.
You know, why Derby? You know, why?
Yeah.
You feel it. It's instinct. It's in there. There's a code in there that we all know that we can't really put a finger on it, but you sense it when you see it and you hear it and you feel it. Yeah.
I find a lot of what I do is for the 14-year-old version of myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because I grew up in the Midwest and gay and without any, like you said, no role models at all because they didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
There was Billy Crystal on Soap.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and kind of Jim J. Bullock or whatever. You know, but that was really it. And even now, although, you know, there's a gay character in every show, it tends to be the same gay character.
Yeah, it is sort of the same gay character. And it's funny, you know, musically during the 80s, there was only a handful of people who were creating gay-specific music. You know, Tom Robinson, Jimmy right. Somerville, and I guess later when he stopped being coy, Boy George. So, you know, I mean, androgyny was always part of rock, but, you know, these guys who self-identified as gay musicians, that wasn't the road for me because I felt like it would put my music in a place where it might limit the audience that I could reach. And, you know, whether that's good or bad, you know, it's too late to change it, but that was where I was coming from.
Right.
And as far as role models, I mean, you know, with my coming out in 94, you know, I just had such a weird view of the community because so much of it was coming out of the 80s where we were told we were bad and, you know, we caused this disease that was killing people. And, you know, going from that to the 90s where there was Lesbian Chic, which I couldn't identify with. And then, you know, the media was still holding up the flamboyant characters at the Pride Parade. They never showed the teachers. They never showed the elderly. It was always the people who were, you know, very, very colorful.
Yeah.
And no problem with that, but I couldn't identify there either.
Right.
It was funny. I had a weird time finding my place.
And you not only sort of created alternative rock within the United States with Husker Du, you sort of reaped the benefits of it with Sugar.
Yeah.
You really, for the first time, found acceptance on the radio. There was alternative radio.
Yeah, after two solo records, after Workbook and Black Sheets of Rain, I was sort of left to my own devices in 1991, and I went out and did a lot of solo acoustic touring and played a lot of shows with Sonic Youth and Dinosaur Jr. and Nirvana, people who I knew who, you know, were either part of the scene that I came from or were influenced by that scene. And, you know, when Nevermind came out, I think we all knew that, you know, the battle had been won and that our kind of music was going to be the music for the next 3 or 4 years.
Right.
And I had a group called Sugar that put out records in 92, 3, and 4, so we were definitely there to, you know, catch some of the spoils.
Let's hear some Sugar right now. This is Hoover Dam. Your interview with Spin Magazine, in which you come out, and you're very hard on yourself for that article.
Yeah,
or for the way that you feel that you were perceived in that article.
It was a series of missteps. You know, for
how so?
Well, for so long I had compartmentalized my sexuality separate from my work. I didn't want to be singing gay specific music. I wanted a universal audience, so the work remains gender neutral. You know, I strive for that and I strive for that. My sexuality, of course, is an open secret out in the field. Since I'm not writing homophobic music, I'm not getting called on the carpet. You know, I get a pass. 1994, Sugar is very successful. Sugar's looking to be a huge band, so negotiations happen. Spin Magazine offers up as much space as I want, but it's the Bob is Gay story.
And you know that going in.
And I know that going in. Easy way, hard way. Do easy way, so I think. Dennis Cooper, novelist, big fan of the band, Husker Du, big fan of the band Sugar. He gets the assignment, comes to Texas for 2 days. We have a great time. We do 1 hour of on-the-record time. Within that 1 hour, I make a statement, which is part of a larger statement about the media and their representation of gay culture. You know, crazy gym bunnies on a float wearing cod pieces.
Yeah.
I can't identify. So I'm talking about the media and not being able to connect and saying, you know, I'm not a freak. I don't like being represented as one. The byline, the pull quote for the article becomes, I'm not a freak.
Yeah.
And when it stands alone, it really looks terrible.
Yeah.
It just looks horrifying to me. I'm like, oh, great. This is what I get. You know, I blurt. You know, I don't always say the right thing because I'm not sure what the right thing is.
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Dave Holmes, in for Jesse Thorne. My guest is musician Bob Mould, whose memoir is called See a Little Light, The Trail of Rage and Melody. You took some time off to work with wrestling.
Yes.
Work with WCW,
WCW,
I
yeah.
Why? How did it happen?
Why?
Yeah, I mean,
why.
You know.
Because who doesn't want to hang out with Bill Goldberg?
Of course.
Wrestling was a passion of mine. I was a fan of it as a kid. I became a student of it during the punk days in the 80s. I got to meet people who were in the business that smartened me up, as we call it, you know, to how it all works. And by the late 90s, I had befriended a lot of people, mostly at WCW, who used to try a couple of different ideas that I would give them. And a spot opened up in September of 1999. They wanted me to come in and be the creative consultant, which meant I wore a number of different hats. I would sit in on the writing meetings, try to come up with characters, try to develop vignettes to introduce these characters. I was also sort of the go-to person during the live shows. I was sitting behind the curtain, literally giving people their cues and, right. you know, telling the referees on wireless earpieces when and how much and do this again, you know, tell them to do more of that and, yeah. you know, and trying to hit all of our commercial spots. I mean, it was a crazy, you know, a Broadway, live Broadway soap opera, a new one every two times a week. They're the toughest guys in the world, yet so fragile. Because, yes. you know, they're like actors. I mean, they, am I doing good? Was that okay? I think I can do better, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of that, you know.
You also got very into electronic music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was around the same time. You know, right before I went off to wrestling job, that was 1999 was the year that I was trying to build claim and own my gay identity. And, mm-hmm. you know, again, in New York City at that time, it was, you know, the soundtrack was electronic music. It was Madonna. It was Cher. It was all the global underground DJs, you know, Sasha and Digweed, Jimmy Van Am, Paul Van Dyke, that kind of music, you know, was everywhere. So, yeah, you know, my frustration with indie rock combined with trying to claim my gay identity, and in doing so, the soundtrack was this electronic music.
And there's still elements of that in your work.
Yeah. Over the years, I've steered myself back towards my more confessional singer-songwriter mode. So I have this interesting balance now, which is real nice. I have these sort of this duality that there are moments when it overlaps, but I enjoy them both for different reasons.
Right. You've sampled so many things in your career, and now it's just sort of, now there's a well-balanced meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just the ukulele stuff is hard. It's a hard instrument to master.
Obviously very difficult. Theme in See a Little Light is write it and it shall be so. You say that a lot, and there are things that you write about in your songs which immediately come to pass.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. Oh, I think we all have the power to do that. I mean, that's how the world moves, is you have an idea, you have something in your head. You think to yourself, you know, I really wish that I could make that tree go away. You know, and then if you put it out there in the universe, if you open your mouth and the words come out, you may come back and that tree may be ready to die.
Yeah.
It's funny how that works. And as with everything, it has two sides. You know, it's a blessing to have that, but it's also a curse when you use it.
Yeah, you mentioned that many times in the book, and these things, you know, things that you have been writing about do come to pass.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the most glaring example would be the year 1995. I'm living in Austin, Texas, and I'm with my second longtime partner. We're about 6 years into our relationship, and for whatever reason, I sequestered myself away from him, mostly to get space, but also to write what would be my first solo record post-Sugar. And the contents of the record were the chronicling of a painful breakup. And sure enough, you know, I didn't get that record finished, but within 2 months we were pretty much done as a couple. You know, there's a glaring example of write it and it shall be so.
Exactly. And so, there are many more in the book.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a fun side thread. Yeah. Right.
Bob Mould's book, See a Little Light, The Trail of Rage and Melody, is out now. Bob Mould, thank you for being here.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Anymore.
That is it for The Sound of Young America this week. I have been your host, Dave Holmes. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our editor is Nick White. Our music is by Dan Wally. And you can find us online at MaximumFun.org, where you can find past episodes of this show, as well as several other programs, such as Jordan Jesse Go, Judge John Hodgman, and Stop Podcasting Yourself. If you'd like to hear me talk more, you can swing by my website at adrinkwithdave.com. Many thanks to Jesse Thorne for having me in this week. It has been a pleasure, and I hope to see you again soon.
Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.